From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
Whatever you're going to do, just try and elevate it to the next level.
Somebody said, pine. Everything must be made of pine.
That I shouldn't have my shorts on because the working men were coming in and I would make them feel uncomfortable.
Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily, how to stop Cork City from falling down. It's time to up your picnic game for the summer. And the best harness for when you take your goat for a walk. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that 8 out of 10 teddy bears would bring to their next picnic. Let's begin with the Ryan Tuberty Show's newsings, as gleaned from the papers and other sources and filtered through the mouth of the host. And we'll dive in during the history portion of the newsings. Ryan in his happy place.
When I watched the news again last night and I see the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach at Dublin Castle announcing details of the commemorations for the various centenaries that are happening, including the very tricky war, the Civil War, among other things. But I saw, she was on the show with us not too long ago, Dr. Audrey Whitty, who is the head of collections at Collins Barracks, in other words, dream job. And she's a very, very nice person indeed and a very smart person, because we were chatting again on the late, late before we went on air, herself and a couple of her colleagues. And they were saying, you should come over and essentially and come and play in the collection, because there's so much stuff, you'd love it. And I was saying, really? There's a sword that Kennedy gave to someone? So, okay, we've got to arrange this date. this play date with me and you guys and just go mad like history nerds together. And she was saying that she had, of course, had this pen that Michael Collins used to sign the treaty in Downing Street. And if you saw the little bit of banter between Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar, Leo Varadkar says, like a kid in a school tour goes, how do you know that's the real one? Like, that's great. Kind of innocence to the question, to which Micheál Martin said to him, "You're an awful doubting Thomas, you know." And it was banter, but it's funny those objects. You're kind of, how do you know? It's a fair question. You're kind of, but that's all about provenance, and that's when you're looking at historical objects, as we did that time with Countess Markovich is gone and Padraig Pearse is gone and the pen that Daniel O'Connell used to sign something else. And these are all, the provenance is so important. And that brings us back to those programmes that we were talking about, all about fraudulent documents like Murder Among the Mormons, like Sour Grapes, Fake Wine, and the other one that we talked about, the art world, Now You See Me. Provenance, art, it all stretches to how do you know it's real? It's a fair question under the circumstances. But interesting, just the news was fascinating last night, and now we're looking at a series of reopenings coming up down the tracks. I think we know on Thursday for sure what exactly is happening, but we've got good ideas, and there seem to be good vibes about vaccination rollout, as they call it. And I'm glad to see the Irish Mirror.ie reporting that something we were hoping would happen is happening, that street furniture fees. This is important if you're trying to have a business outdoors, as they've been trying to. And I was saying a few weeks ago, please don't be charging people for outdoor dining, especially the pub owners and the restaurant owners and hotel owners. They've enough fees and costs, and they're trying to play catch up. They're going to be running to stand still for a long time, so they need all the support they can get, and they're getting it. In fairness, in this regard, pubs and restaurants will be able to put tables and chairs outside for free this summer. This is a good result. Again, these are the things that I keep saying that we keep seeing happening in Cork and Limerick, and now more and more widespread around the country.
It's a little early, you would have thought, but what about a mention of the 2021 toy show?
I had two intriguing meetings yesterday. One was a toy show meeting to discuss the theme for the next toy show in November. And that went very well, very, very exciting. And again, innovation. But the other meeting, about not only this Friday's Late Late Show, but projecting into the future, talks about audiences. And we are all hungry to have an audience back every Friday. And I think we're edging closer and closer to it. I mean, I don't know. We've been told nothing to that effect other than just my own hope. But I just think the way things are going, we can certainly be looking at an audience. And by hook or by crook, you can have 200. My promise has been and continues to be that the first audience will be frontline workers only, to say thanks. And that stands. They're all vaccinated. So if we'll see how it goes. But that's the plan. It's going to be a fascinating summer, that's for sure.
But fascinating in a good way, we hope, right? Like lockdown-inspired musical collaborations.
Lockdown has meant the curtailment of many things in the music world, but it has helped foster creative relationships in some cases too, according to entertainment.ie. One of them is between Paul Noonan, best known for fronting BellX1, and Clare-based electronic musician Dahi, also known as Dahi. And they have worked together before, and now they have a new band called Houseplants, so we wish them well. And they are going to have a single called What's With All The Pine? Oh, no, sorry, that's not what it's called. They teased their debut single. Yeah, What's With All The Pine? That's it, yeah. Sometimes you watch some of those programs, like Goodbye House in particular, and you find yourself asking that question. What's With All The Pine? Ireland went through a phase, I think mostly in the 80s and much of the 90s, where somebody said, pine. Everything must be made of pine. Even the dishwasher and the washing machine and the counters and the windows must be made of pine. Why? People love pine. Don't even give them the choice. Just build everything out of pine. It's going to work beautifully.
I know it sounds crazy now, but he's dead right. Just think back to the last B&B you stayed in. Anyway, on to Tubbs' buddy Stephen Fry on social media.
Stephen Fry tweeted, he said, I'd forgotten what a pleasant thing a cheese and tomato sandwich is. I'm aware that this is one of the dullest and most banal tweets in history. Accept my apologies. Still, they're nice. And he got such a response to it. He wrote back a little while later, so many more instant responses to a tweet about tomato sandwiches than any post I've ever made about the state of the world or the future of the human race. I love you, Britain. And not just Britain, of course. Mostly, but not all. Apologies, rest of the world. You never know sometimes what people respond to the most. And we find that all the time. You could make a program about world peace and make a passing comment about a sandwich. And all that'll come in is, you got the wrong bread, you should try this butter. This marmalade is nice. Have you tried that with salt? You didn't eat that. You didn't do that the right way. You should put butter on them. It comes through the holes of the marietta. You know, you just never know. People love to advise and help and suggest, and there's nothing wrong with that.
And when someone suggests something useful, do you thank them? Do they say you're welcome? No, because according to the Huffington Post, we don't say that anymore.
Why do we say you're welcome anymore? We say, no problem, no worries, anytime, of course, sure thing, uh-huh, you get it. All these things, instead of, you're welcome. But the reasons for the decline do not necessarily come from a place of rudeness, nor is you're welcome simply another thing that millennials are bent on killing. In some ways, it comes from a desire to be more considerate. And they got on to an etiquette person who said, I think people worry that with you're welcome, it's an expectation that this person should have thanked you. And they did, in fact, do the right thing. People feel that it's less humble. You're welcome also gets a snarky reputation. Indeed, when did you're welcome become a gloat is a question that's been asked. And comedians use you're welcome. Stephen Colbert used to use it. And Will Ferrell in his very funny George W. Bush play. Did you see that one? You're welcome, America. I mean, that's a perfect example of the sarcasm of it, if you like. And it's you're welcome. And Moana. What can I say but you're welcome? Great song in the film. And of course, it's about hubris and arrogance and everything else. So yeah, you're welcome appears to be on the way out. And if you didn't know that information, you're welcome.
See what he did there? If you thought that was the pits, get a load of this next musings extract.
Another piece I read about how this American life, yeah, they talked about people who play in the orchestra pit. And this is something that I always find about performers. I could never be an actor. I could never be a stage or particularly a stage actor because I couldn't handle the repetition of it every single day. I always think of Andrew Scott when I went to see him in the West End in playing Hamlet. Thinking, this is 3 hours. This is Shakespearean in every respect. And that was just Tuesday night. Then there's Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday twice, you know, and on it goes, and all these performers. But it's the orchestra pit then, that's another thing. And this comment was made about how, if you take the Phantom of the Opera, take any of them, on Broadway, and how like a sizable majority of them had been playing the show since it opened in 1988 on Broadway, it was 86 in the West End, according to this, because their contract stipulated that they'd have jobs throughout the show's entire run, but nobody anticipated that it would run forever and ever and ever. And none of these people wanted to walk away from a guaranteed job, so very few of them quit. So they just kept doing the same show night after night for 20, some of them 30 years. Phantom Not. Sing once again with me. My power over me. Grow stronger, yeah. Could you imagine the torture? Dun, 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 dun. Over and over again. And by the time it finally closed last year, most of these musicians who had been working together for decades hated each other and actually really, really loathed Phantom. This person was saying, I can't stop thinking about it. It's indescribably hellish to imagine, but also the funniest thing I've ever heard in my life. And somebody made the point that one of my favourite stories, which should drive anyone who has ever played in a band crazy, there's this bassoon player who has sat next to the same clarinet player since 1988, and she's convinced he plays half a note flat on every note he's ever played. And he denies it. Could you imagine the pain? The pain. Anyway, it is indeed, as somebody else pointed out, a sitcom, The Mighty Wind. It's the best in show. It's that style waiting to happen about the orchestra pit below the big show. Somebody get onto that.
They should make a musical about the shenanigans that happen in the orchestra pit during the run of a never-ending musical. Double the orchestras, double the entertainment, right? Yeah, we'd better leave the Ryan Tuberty Show newsings for today before it's too late. In recent years, Cork City has experienced a number of incidents involving parts of buildings falling onto public footpaths, and many other buildings have fallen into a dangerous state of disrepair. Why is dereliction an issue in Ireland's fastest growing city? Today with Clare Byrne reporter Brian O'Connell told Clare what he'd found out this morning.
Now, the issue is particularly sensitive in Cork because in 1999, part of a building fell from Washington Street and it killed 20-year-old Aoife Bell and seriously injured some of those who were with her. Since then, and in recent years and months, while there is significant new development in Cork City, there have been several issues around older buildings in the city centre in places such as North Main Street, Tucky Street, and most recently on Liberty Street. And a number of portions of footpaths are closed currently in the city centre.
Brian met a couple who've moved back to Ireland from Amsterdam. Frank O'Connor and Jude Sherry have been tracking dereliction in Cork City. And Brian took a stroll with Frank and Jude, beginning on North Main Street.
You've got like five actual properties in a row here, going from the actually in gable and five properties up. And predominantly built between 1750 and 1840. And some of them have actually been crumbling for quite a good few years. We've looked back on Google Maps.
Back in 2009, the garters, support garters in the front of some of the buildings are still existing, but mostly that the buildings on the upper floors aren't being used. And unfortunately what happened to these buildings in front of us is they actually collapsed in 2019. That whole side of the street was closed off and you couldn't walk along it. So it's quite depressing to see such key old buildings being left.
I suppose from our point of view, we'd love to see these buildings brought back to life.
So that was in the last year or two. Since then, we've had another event.
2 days ago?
Yeah.
Yeah. The buildings right beside it on the end, we'll just walk up towards them now, right beside it, the end gable building, parts of the building fell off again. So now that part of the footpath's cordoned off again. We can no longer access it.
And this isn't a side street. This is right bang in the city centre.
Absolutely. This is busy thoroughfare.
And you lived in Amsterdam, and Amsterdam's an old city. Would you have come across this in Amsterdam?
They have a very strict building controls and very strict vacant and dereliction controls. So you don't see derelict buildings in Amsterdam. But also they have very strict maintenance controls on buildings. So you have to work with the council owners to make sure that your building's kept up.
People want to live in the city centres in Europe. They want to live in the old historic parts. And they want to be part of that fabric. Whereas in Ireland, what we've realised is people want to move out of the city. Now, I suppose we're convinced from our work that people will move to the cities in the next 5 to 10 years.
The stroll moved on to Tucky Street.
So we're in Tucky Street again in the old part of the city to a certain extent. We're just off the Grand Parade, and we're just close to a building that sadly collapsed or started to collapse. Maybe was it like a year and a half ago?
Yeah, this is some time ago. You can see the fabric, the front of the building has actually, you can see the crack all the way up it. Put up huge metal structures, closed off the footpath, and put up huge metal structures to keep the front of the building up. and standing.
An important message really is that the most sustainable building is the existing one. So you should always walk with what you have. I mean, obviously before COVID, a few friends came over from the Netherlands as it happened, and they were quite surprised because we took them for a walk around. They were, I guess, quite surprised and didn't really understand why we didn't respect our buildings, you know. And it's a hard question to answer, you know.
Owners of dangerous buildings can be prosecuted, they can be fined.
I know both of you on Twitter are quite active and you're highlighting instances now.
Because we walked all over the world, so we came back here. And I suppose we fell in love with the city through Twitter. We started sharing images of derelict buildings. And from that then we've done a study of over 300 properties that are derelict in the city.
And what have you found?
Yeah, so we looked at all the publicly available information for over 300 buildings. So what we found is that there's a lot of myths around why derelict buildings are left derelict. And unfortunately those myths, they aren't true. So things like planning is holding back, rather than actually only 9% of the derelict buildings we found had planning refused on them, whereas over 70% of the buildings had let their planning go lapse. So planning wasn't actually being a barrier
so
to buildings getting
So what do you think is happening?
Done.
Are people sitting on properties?
Some companies might be actually just sitting on and waiting for the value to increase. So what we would love to see is the council to set up a one-stop shop, so owners, especially in the historic core, can go to the council and ask for help.
We're going to hear a little bit now from Erin O'Brien. She's a City Centre Coordinator with Cork City Council, and also Alison O'Rourke, who's a Senior Executive in the Housing Department. I asked Alison O'Rourke first if there is an up-to-date audit of buildings in disrepair within the City Council.
Being regularly done, you know, so it's not like we don't have an inspection regime or a constant ongoing inspection or proactive response to derelict sites that is taking place. You need to listen as well, and if stakeholders are raising the issue that there are sites out there not getting on the register, that's something that we're very aware of. And we are resourcing a unit in the City Council at the moment that will be cross-collaborating between building control and our derelict site section, and looking at things with the overall holistic view, as well as trying to find solutions with people.
Because sometimes it may fall between...
It could be derelict, not dangerous. It could be dangerous, not derelict. It could be a mixture of both, and it's something that we're putting together to prioritise the urban fabric.
We often just think that it's someone who's sitting on a building and speculating. That can be the case some of the time, but there's a lot of other reasons that people might have issues with their buildings as well. If you might be tied up in probate, or what was interesting in working in derelict sites, didn't realise how much emotional issues could come into buildings as well. Sometimes it can be very difficult to make a development stack up. I think a lot of disinvestment would have happened in Ireland in the past when people literally did not have money to do these buildings up.
Over the shop living is coming in now as an opportunity to us that we hadn't seen before, you know, so there's definitely opportunity out there, and people are seeing empty buildings that aren't in necessarily bad condition, but they want to bring people living into the city again. And
if I own a building in a city centre, and if part of that building is not maintained, if it's derelict, if it falls onto the street, we've had a number of instances of it, what can you do about it?
There's a toolbox of things. The Derelict Sites Register is the one that people would be most familiar with. From there, if it's on the register, you can charge a levy. From there, if no work is done, you can compulsorily acquire it. Now, I say that simply. It's not that simple in many cases, but it is a powerful tool, and it is one that we have been using.
That's Brian O'Connell's report on dereliction in Cork City on This Morning's Today with Claire Byrne. Lauren told Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline about a bizarre and frankly unsettling encounter she had at work recently.
So yesterday I was in work, whatever, and I had a pair of shorts on. Mm-hmm. And I got told that I shouldn't work out, shouldn't have my shorts on because the working men were coming in and I would make them feel uncomfortable.
So yesterday being a glorious day, the weather is getting better. You were, as is normal, not unusual, you decided to wear shorts.
Yes.
And your place of work.
Yeah.
And what was it... Were you told to change or just to...
Yeah, no, I was told to change out of my shorts because I'd make people feel uncomfortable. And to be honest, I was kind of in shock. I didn't say anything back to this person. I was in shock. I was kind of like, wait, what? Like.
And did they say, Lauren, that you'll make the men uncomfortable?
Yes, that I'd make the men feel uncomfortable, that they were older men and that... You know, they're from a different generation, that I should change out of my choice because they'd feel uncomfortable, rather than me being uncomfortable in a heavy pair of jeans or trousers.
Yeah, yeah. And what did you do?
I went back to work. I had stuff to do. I kind of just went on with my day. It was a common day, and I just kept going with my day, to be honest with you. I didn't do anything.
And did the male colleagues in your workplace, did they go around all afternoon looking uncomfortable?
No. Well, I didn't really see them because I was in a different room or whatever. So, but I presume that they were fine.
Now, do you? Well, give me the energy that was in the request from your colleague. Was she being like, was she acting in a supervisory role, or she would have been uncomfortable? Do you follow me?
Yeah, I'm not sure. To be honest, again, I think it's a different generation that she's older than me, and she was thinking that from more of her point of view, from the generation that she is, that she was like, well, we women have to change our appearances to make the men feel comfortable, if you get what I mean.
Yeah,
I don't think there was any harshness in the comment she made. I think it was just maybe uneducated on her behalf. I don't think it was a dig or anything like that.
Okay,
I think it was just...
And this is on foot of what we were talking about yesterday. I mentioned that the Ursula von der Leyen of the EU saying sexism was alive and well at every level of the EU after she was humiliated by President Erdogan of Turkey, and indeed the President of the EU Commission, who happens to be a man, or the EU Council happens to be a man. So previous examples, any examples of that is kind of sexism. What about your daily life and...
Yeah, so there was another incident. I'm sure every woman has loads of incidents they can talk about. But there was another incident that happened when I was in my local shop, and I was just getting bits for dinner or whatever. And I walked to the till with the smallest line, and it happened that there was a man in front of me, and he was buying alcohol. And that was grand. The man turned around to me and said, "Oh, I just forgot something." So he said, "I said, that's fine. I'll just wait until you come back." He stumbled by me and he did rub off me, and at the time I was like, nah, it's a stumble, nothing to worry about. On his way back, he came back and he pinched my bum. And I was kind of in shock. I didn't know what to do. I was kind of like, do I say something? And I didn't. He went about his day, I went about mine, and I went home. And there was a person at home, and I explained the situation to them, and they said, "Oh, well, why did you line up behind someone that was just buying alcohol? Like, I should have to be aware of who I line up behind." And the other comment that was made was I sure that's what happened? And the third comment that was made was, why didn't you tell anyone? Why didn't you say to the person at the till that this happened? Or why didn't I alert anyone to the incident? And it was almost like I was being given out to for something that happened to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well... There is an argument in this jurisdiction elsewhere that a pinch on the bum is an indecent assault.
Yeah, and it is. But I feel like a lot of women, especially women maybe in their 20s, have experienced this, whether it's been in a nightclub or it's been out on the streets. And like, I can turn around to any one of my friends and ask them, and they'll have a story to tell you at all. So it's just heartbreaking, really.
No, I was looking up earlier. Went to the one issue on this is being pinched in the bum. It was an Australian case, and it was a policeman who pinched somebody at a charity event, but he was wearing the uniform, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court. But it's still. They were talking about this new phenomenon. Well, it's 5 years, 10 years, twerking and all this carry on, and changes in dancing. But you should be allowed to dance the way you want to dance. So, Lauren, is that it over with you? The good weather. Well, it's cold today, but it's due to come back. You're not going to be, I hope, put off wearing what you want.
No. No. Like, I mean, the way that I said it when I was explaining the story to another person was, if I was a man wearing shorts, would I get asked? If I was a man wearing GA shorts, would I get asked to change? No.
Absolutely.
And these shorts are about the same length, so I'm not going to, for the weather, I want to stand my legs. I'm not going to cover them up.
And we got, as you know, this time last year, we had a very animated debate for one day only about normal people. But we never got any calls about Paul Mescal's GAA shorts.
Yeah, which is great. It's mind-blowing, really.
And he's nominated himself. And Daisy are nominated for a BAFTA today again because of his role in those GAA shorts, so to speak.
Yeah.
Okay, Lauren, go about your work. Enjoy the summer. And yeah, you're right. Stand up to that type of behaviour.
Yeah.
Okay, look after yourself.
Perfect.
Lauren, thanks.
That's Lauren talking to Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline about two recent experiences of sexism in work and in a supermarket. Extraordinary what Lauren and so many other women are expected to put up with. Apparently it's National Youth Workers Week. I did not know this, but Ryan Tuberty did, and he decided he wanted to talk to people involved in youth work. Cue Peg O'Sullivan.
I suppose I got into the area because I was one of those young people. It's a very personal story.
Okay.
So I was raised in a council estate. I entered into the school system in secondary school. My mother was in a very serious car accident just as I was entering into secondary school.
Yeah.
And my dad had to work, so there was a lot of responsibility put on me as a teenager. My younger sister was only 10 months old at the time.
Mm.
So I saw school as having the crack.
Okay.
Get away from the responsibility at home and I'd go in and have the crack. And I learned very quickly that fitting in and having a bit of crack got you attention.
Sure.
And I craved that connection because home life was quite serious. And so I craved that connection to have a bit of crack. So I was the type of girl that would be found down the back of the school shed smoking fags. Just trying to fit in with anyone, you know, and I was going down a very dangerous path, just trying to escape the responsibilities that were happening.
Yeah.
So I left school with no leaving cert.
Okay.
And I became a teen mom. So mm-hmm. I had my first child at 17.
Mm-hmm.
And I had decided that was life, you know, this was it. This was it for me. I was working in a local chip shop at the time. I was quite content in that I didn't have any other choice. This is the way it's going to be. And I just had to accept that.
Mm.
And when my little girl was 3, Lauren, she was in play school and she announced to the school one day that she was going to be a burglar just like her mom.
Okay.
When the teacher said it to me, my heart sank. I was like, they're imagining I'm around robbing houses.
Oh, no. Okay.
So I said, a burglar. And she was like, yeah, Mom, I want to cook burgers and chips just like you. And it was in that moment that I realized I have to make a change, you know.
Right.
I was content because I didn't believe I had a choice, but I certainly didn't want this life for my daughter. I wanted her, like nurses and teachers were the epitome of employment at the time, you know. So I wanted her to be a nurse or a teacher, and I just realized if I need to make a change, I had to make a change with myself. I had to show up for her. And so that day I signed up to redo my leaving cert, and it kind of took off from there. I was now, choices had opened up to me.
Did you leave the chipper behind you, Peg?
I did, but I had great crack there, Ryan. I have to say. It was probably one of the best jobs that I had.
But you got to meet people from all walks of life, you know, in terms of over the counter. I think chippers are brilliant places, very sociable.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Well, I couldn't afford to go a night out because I didn't have the money to do it. But in the chipper at 3 o'clock in the morning, you meet some great characters.
I'd say
some great crack, you know.
Yeah.
But I suppose the whole point of the story is it's not to get a pat on the back and look how great you are. It's that I didn't believe I had choices, and only for the fact that I had such great support from my family, and I had a group of friends that were quite supportive. I mean, being a 17-year-old pregnant mom in 1993, I think the snapper had just been released at the time.
Nice one, Sharon. A1 Sharon, yeah.
I was called Sharon.
Come on.
Do you know what I mean? But there was a lot of judgment placed on my family, and there's a lot of judgment placed on me, and my parents were judged, and I had great support from them. And when you hear other young people saying, you know, I'm not allowed to hang out with you anymore, it was like you were a leper, you know, and that feeling, that impact was just I wanted to give something back to young people in the community, and that's why I went down this road.
What is a youth worker? I mean, it's, to me, that's an abstract expression. I can't, yeah. I don't really understand it. So it sounds like it's essentially you work with youth, but could you give me a better definition of it?
Well, I suppose years ago, it would have been a youth club or an after-school club. That's kind of what it was years ago. But it's changed dramatically over the last number of years. So I work for an organisation called the Kerry Diocesan Youth Service, so the KDYS. And within the organisation, we would have a number of different projects. So the projects would cater for the wider need of the community. So we would have a Garda Youth Diversion Project. We would have Alcohol and Drug Abuse Project. And we have the Generic Youth Information and Generic Youth Workers working with young people, LGBT community. And then also you'd have the Family Support Service within the organisation. And that's where I'm working. So I'm a worker with the family support side of things. So basically, Ryan, our job is to link in with families and young people that are vulnerable or targeted within the community and to support them in whatever support looks like for them. And I suppose the difference between a youth worker or maybe a teacher or somebody else in society that's trying to teach the children, we're not going to try and teach them, we're going to connect with them. Mm. So my thing is always that when we were going through this pandemic, we had to go overnight we took online. And as a youth worker, that's very difficult because the bulk of our work is the connection with the young people. And we're human beings are built for connection. And without that connection, it was really difficult.
Yeah.
So while we went online, and the Family Support Service realised 3 weeks in, we were making videos, putting them up online, trying and support parents, trying to support young people. We realised after 3 weeks, it wasn't possible. Families needed to see us. They needed very practical things, Ryan, that we take for granted. Food.
Mm.
You know, you have families out there that couldn't get enough food in. Food is a source of comfort. We all talk about the COVID stone that we've all put on, and food is a source of comfort. When you're faced with challenges, we sometimes reach for food. And we have families that couldn't go beyond their budget to provide this extra food for their children that are stuck at home now. And throughout the pandemic, I kept hearing the same, sure, we're all in the same boat. And for us as family support workers, we weren't in the same boat. We were in the same storm, but very different boats.
Yeah, I think that is going to be, the closer we get to the end game here, and we're not nearly there, but we're on the road, the more that we're all in the same boat will be proven to be the greatest lie of all time.
Oh, my God.
In terms of financial wealth, mental health, friendship. Family, you know, absolutely that same boat thing is the greatest myth of them all.
It is. And I've, like, for me, it was, we're all in the same storm. Like, I'm in a pandemic.
Much better.
I have my challenges. I've elderly parents, they have underlying health conditions, I've children with asthma.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I'm hit with the same impact. However, my challenges are a lot less. I live in a 4-bedroom detached house with a huge garden. I'm closing my front door and I'm going to meet my parent living in homeless accommodation with 5 children that don't have a laptop, they don't have Wi-Fi, they don't even have a television. Mm. Now, that mother is going through the same experience as me. However, the impact is so different. My children all have their own bedrooms. They all have their own laptops. There's 4 televisions in the house. You know, and while me and this woman, we're both human beings faced with the exact same pandemic for the first time in our lives, the impact on us is going to be very different.
Peg, I haven't driven past the canal in Dublin for a year, and I found myself driving past it the other day. And do you know what I noticed? I thought it was like a grotesque music festival. And I'll tell you why I say that, is because I saw music festival tents all along the canal, housing our fellow citizens all winter in the middle of a pandemic. And that's not the same boat.
No, that's not the same boat, Ryan. And those people in those tents are experiencing everything me and you were experiencing.
Okay.
But the impact is so different on them.
That's youth worker Peg O'Sullivan talking to Ryan Tuberty this morning during National Youth Workers Week. Outdoor dining is looking to be the way forward for the summer, and that means it's time to brush up on our picnic prep. Because a few Sangers and a giant bag of crisps just won't cut it in 2021. Claire Byrne asked Holly Dalton, chef and director of Conbini Foods, what it is about picnics that appeals to her.
I think it's because picnics, it's one of these kind of meals. It doesn't really fit into like breakfast, lunch or dinner kind of thing. It's its own separate entity, and it definitely evokes like a sense of occasion, and especially often reminds me of, you know, past summers or, you know, things like that, because we don't get a lot of great weather in Ireland. So whenever we do, we're very good at making the most out of it. And I think a big cornerstone of that is having picnics. It's a big Irish thing, I think.
You're all about the prep, though. You have to be ready for it. So it starts the day before.
Oh, it starts the day before. Oh, yeah. The thing about picnics, like when you arrive on site, when you begin your picnic, the work should be done. You don't want to be stressing over, you know, any kind of prep once you get there, especially because, you know, yourself, when you sit down to a picnic, it's a group of people. Everybody needs to get fed at the same time. You know, there could be kids there. People could be getting antsy. So everything's got to be done like well in advance. Normally, I start the day before with things like, for me, a big one is like chicken drumsticks, chicken wings, anything that has a handle. And I also often wrap the end of a drumstick or the end of a wing a little bit of tinfoil around it. So that's like avoiding any kind of messiness.
And you're having those cold, Holly, are you?
Yes, having them cold.
Controversial.
There's actually a style of a fried chicken called picnic fried chicken. And it's basically fried chicken that is designed to be eaten cold. Like if you make fried chicken and you cool it fast, it's not going to be, look, listen, it's not going to be crazy crispy or anything, but it's still going to be delicious. And it eats really, really nicely cold.
Okay. Promise it's not going to be, as someone in the office said, congealed.
It's not going to be congealed. I'll tell you how things get congealed, okay? It's not going to be congealed. All right, you can take my word for this. It's not going to be congealed. How things get congealed is they're not cooled down fast enough, or they're covered when they're still a little bit warm, and then they go into the fridge and the fat around them kind of congeals and it gets really gross. And look, no one's having a good time if that's going to happen. Like, okay. Let's be honest.
So just take us through how you avoid that again.
Okay, so basically you're going to make your fried chicken or your drumsticks. Like, it doesn't have to be fried chicken. Like, I do drumsticks a lot in the oven with kind of like a barbecue kind of marinade. Do them in the oven. Take them out, cool them fast. You need to cool them fast. Don't cover them when you're cooling them. Cool them in the fridge, kind of like clear a space in the fridge so like nothing else is going to be, you know, heated up while they're cooling. Cool them fast, uncovered, and then once they're totally cold, then you cover them. Often, like I said, wrap a bit of tinfoil around the end, put them in a box with kitchen paper or like a clean cloth, so there's not going to be any gross stuff at the bottom of the Tupperware that nobody wants to see on the picnic, basically. Don't bring that to the picnic.
I've learned something new now. I thought that you weren't supposed to put hot things into the fridge. But it's hot things covered into the fridge. That's the no-no.
Don't cover them. I would let them, like, okay, I'm not saying as soon as they get out of the oven, don't put them in the fridge. Like, let them cool a little bit for about 5 or 10 minutes, then into the fridge.
Okay. All right. We've gone down a chicken drumstick rabbit hole here. Let's come back to the actual picnic, because Japanese fried rice balls, I know you're a big fan of Japanese food, but you want to include these as well.
Oh my God, these are made for picnics. Like, it's probably my life's mission now to get these to catch on at Irish picnics. Like, if people start making these, they're unbelievable. They're called onigiri, they're rice balls, and they're so, so easy to make. You basically just make fried rice with whatever you have, like, you know, any kind of vegetables or eggs or whatever meat you have. Make fried rice, let it cool ever so slightly, and then you're just going to shape it into this kind of triangle shape and you wrap it in seaweed. And they're not messy to pick up because you pick them up with the seaweed on the outside, so you're not getting your fingers dirty or sticky or anything like that. And they're so delicious and they're perfect cold. And I've actually never made them for anyone that they didn't like them. Like, I've been making these for a few years now, but everyone I've ever made them for loves them. And it's such a different thing to have at a picnic. Nothing wrong with sandwiches. Sandwiches are unreal, and we'll get to sandwiches in a minute. But this is just an alternative kind of finger food, savory finger food that is a serious crowd pleaser. And especially kids, like, you know, kids love things like fried rice. You know, it's not a picky kind of thing.
Yeah.
I can't imagine anyone being like, oh, I don't like fried rice.
And on the sandwich front, you're not averse to a cheese and ham, or do you want us to have something a little bit more complex?
Like, if you're going to do cheese and ham is unreal. But, like, do yourself a favor and get really good cheese, really good ham. Get, you know, Hegarty's cheddar. Why don't you do, like, a whole roast ham the day before and you're slicing it that morning? Like, that would be unreal. Whatever you're going to do, just try and elevate it to the next level. In terms of sandwiches, I love like an egg salad sandwich, but I make kind of a Japanese egg salad sandwich. So it's like soft boiled eggs, and you cut them up with a little bit of scallion and then a QP mayonnaise, which is basically like a mayonnaise made with rice vinegar. And it's super, super good. Another sandwich that's unreal is a cold fried chicken sandwich, like with a little bit of spicy mayo and lettuce. Oh my God, like,
but you're
fantastic.
Mad into the cold fried chicken.
Well, if you're gonna make it for the if you're gonna make it for the drumsticks or whatever, you might as well take some of that and make sandwiches out of it.
Absolutely.
You know, you want to cut down on the jobs that you're doing. Another good one I do, which is vegan and it's also unreal, is I do whole roast red peppers in the oven, and let them cool, and then I make a little kind of sweet corn hummus, and like it's a hummus rocket and roasted red pepper sandwich, and that's like really, really tasty.
Gorgeous, lovely. And then you have advice on flasks for hot and cold.
Yeah, I feel like most people in their household are going to have what I call kind of a legacy thermos. It's a thermos that's kind of been like passed down to the generation, and it's like maybe like under a stairs or in the back of a cupboard somewhere. But like, take those out, invest in a good thermos, you know, hot drinks, cold drinks. I think those are like where people fall down in picnics often. Like, I would normally bring at least one flask of hot coffee. If there's going to be kids there, one flask of hot chocolate. And then with the cold drinks, I kind of have a little life hack that I only learned recently. There's a thing you can get for camping, and these aren't expensive, they're super cheap. It's basically called a dry bag, and you can put like things like, you know, whatever, cans of drink and bottles into this dry bag. And if you leave it in a body of water, it keeps it super, super, super cold. So you're not like lugging around a big cooler with you or whatever. And it keeps your drinks really cold, and it's cheap, and it's basically changed my picnic life.
Okay. And you say we shouldn't be afraid to bring ice cream frozen between two biscuits. It'll work.
Yes, it will work. That's something, I'm a massive fan of ice cream sandwiches. Look, there's nothing wrong with an ice burger, but if you make it yourself, it's a total game changer. So you make your cookies, you buy whatever kind of ice cream you like to use, whatever, you know, whatever you're into. Normally like a slab of like vanilla is like very handy for this. And you sandwich the ice cream between two cookies and you put it back in the freezer overnight. And it's going to freeze like quite hard. Like if you took it out of the freezer, you wouldn't be able to eat it straight away. So what I do is wrap those up, put them in the cooler, or you know, those like blocks of kind of liquid that you can freeze for coolers. I don't know what they're called, but they're great as well.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, the blue ones. Put them in your cooler and they're going to stay frozen like for, I'm not messing, at least half an hour. Like, I've tested this myself. So by the time you get to the picnic, they're going to be perfect to eat. They're going to be like a little bit soft, still frozen, but just ideal.
Yeah, I mean, from experience now with children, though, particularly last year when we were in lockdown and the world was all new within our 2K and then our 5K, they'll eat anything once it's outside. You know, the novelty factor?
Absolutely.
Things taste better outside for some reason.
Things taste better outside, even for adults, though. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. you're going to find yourself getting excited about like sandwiches and potato salad, even though you eat these things all the time. But when you're outside, you're like, wow, look at this. Like, are we on holiday? What's going on?
Brilliant. Just add crisps. Holly Dalton, chef and director of Combini Foods, talking picnics with Claire Byrne this morning. The Ray Darcy Show has been taking pictures from listeners who've spotted unusual animals on leads around the country. This afternoon, Ray spoke to Claire Coleman, who regularly takes her goat, yes, in a harness for a walk.
That is you. You have a pet goat.
That's me. Yeah, that's me and Doris.
Doris, right, Doris. And Doris, yeah. Doris has a pink harness.
She has a pink harness and a pink lead, but people still call her a boy.
Right, okay. They should know.
They should know when you see the pink.
Yeah. So tell us that picture. Where was that taken?
It was taken in the retail park. She was going into EquiPet to get her next size up in her harness.
Ah, so she'd grown out of the pink one. Did you manage to get...
She's getting bigger.
Did you manage to get her bigger pink harness?
Yeah, she got a lot of attention. Well, she gets a lot of attention wherever she goes, but right. EquiPet were very helpful.
Great.
So, yeah, we tried it on her for size. So, yeah, we left with her next size up.
I love it. Doris is a brilliant name. How did you end up with a pet goat, Claire?
My boyfriend, Stefan, would have a lot of animals out at his house.
Right.
And I kind of said a few times, I'd like my own animal. Like, I'd like to visit my own animal. And he kind of put it out there, but I thought it was just in jest. And he said, well, your birthday is coming up, so I can get you a goat. So I didn't take him serious. And we were then spinning about, and he said, so he's like, what would you call a goat? And I was thinking it would be a boy, and I said, oh, Timothy. Yeah. And he said, but if it was a girl? And I said, oh, I'm not sure. And he said, well, maybe you better get your thinking cap on, because we're going over to see a goat. So I had been in my parents for a cup of tea, and I didn't tell them I was going to get a goat.
Why not?
And I said,
why not?
I'm just going, the pink lockdown has got to me. We're not a pet orientated family at all. I've never even had a puppy before.
Right.
So yeah, they're a bit amused by it.
Okay,
yeah.
So off you go to pick out the goat. Where did you go to get the goat?
It was a goat farm in County Louth, so just near Ardee.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm. And Stefan came in, and you were, how many goats had you to choose from?
There was two, so there was a smaller white one and there was Doris. So I was thinking the white one might look a bit grubby if I had her out for a walk. So I liked Doris's colouring. She was very friendly.
And what's Doris's colouring?
She kind of is like between a grey and brown, and then she has markings on her face that she has a bit of white, and then she has white feet.
And the owner of the original owner of Doris knew that you were getting Doris as a birthday present and as a pet.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
He was afraid to put her in the car. He said, the car looks very clean. Maybe put her in the boot. And I was saying, oh no, she's only 2 weeks old. I can't be putting her in the boot. So I was like, no, she's a pet. I was like, she can come in the car. So she still comes in the car.
Right. What about, as they say, soiling? What about soiling the car? She doesn't soil it.
No, she's actually a very good traveller. Have to say, she's had no accidents in the car so far.
Okay.
So hopefully I don't jinx her.
And where do you keep her at home?
She is in Stefan's garden.
Aha, right. And does she come into the house at all?
She does, even when she's not supposed to. But she's like a giddy puppy, so she follows. So if you go too far away from her, she'll come and find out where you are, and she's very inquisitive. So she's always in for a look about. She tried to get up my stairs the other day.
Right. You'll have to get one of those gates. What, you know, the baby gates? You'll have to get
a baby gate.
You'll have to get one of those. Yeah, and what about the chewing on things?
Yeah, she's actually still being bottle fed, so she needs to be weaned in the next 2 weeks. But she's nibbling away at everything already. So yeah, including socks and shoes and coats. So yeah, everything.
Can you spot her personality, Doris's personality?
Yeah, I wasn't sure getting a goat if they would have any type of personality. But straight over she was nuzzling in, and she's quite giddy. She can jump quite high, actually.
Right.
So she's full of fun.
Yeah, right. And what about, you know, when she's weaned and she starts nibbling more and she gets a bit bigger and a bit more active? That's all okay with you, is it?
That's okay. Stefan might have to take over. I mightn't be strong enough to hold her on her lead anymore. But
And where do you bring her for a walk, Claire?
Oh, she's been everywhere. She was in the retail park going to Equipet.
Yeah.
She was in my sister's estate. She was in the local coffee shop.
Right.
And then she goes to the local shop in the village.
Right.
She's all around.
I'd say she turns heads, does she?
She definitely does. Yeah.
Now, I know you...
So she's tame.
She's tame, yeah.
Yeah, she's quite tame around children. She's quite good.
Right. And I know you said you didn't have any other pets. No, you'd never had a pet at all. Right.
Never, no.
So you can't compare Doris, for example, to a dog. So you don't know.
No, but I know she can't bark, so she's...
That's an advantage, yes. So you're going to probably get a bit of this. Yeah.
She sounds like a lamb.
Or this. Is that more like her...
Yes. When you leave her and she doesn't want to be left,
Poor little Doris. Little Doris. And would you sit in of an evening now watching telly with Doris on your lap?
No. Try not to let her in to the house for too long.
Right, she'll get used to it. No, I'm just looking at a picture of you with Doris on your lap, but that's outside, is it? That's outside.
That's outside.
It's brilliant. And the pink harness is lovely. I wonder, do other people have pet goats? So we've done. I don't know if you're listening, but we've done rabbits and we've done ferrets and cats out for a walk, and now a goat. So we're looking for the list of unusual
pets.
What's next? Yes.
I might get another pet.
What would you like next? I'm not sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Because I know Stefan has chickens and turkeys and peahens, does he?
Yeah, he does, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how the birds would work on a leash. Probably
wouldn't
work.
I can't put them on a leash.
No.
Yeah.
Claire Coleman telling Ray Darcy about her pet goat Doris this afternoon. The mind boggles, really. How do the mountains, the lakes and the sea influence the fortunes and future of a country or a region? Author and former diplomatic editor at Sky News, Tim Marshall's new book, The Power of Geography, 10 Maps That Reveal the Future of Our World, has the answer to this question. It's a follow-up to his best-selling book, Prisoners of Geography. Tim spoke to Claire Byrne this morning.
I've heard you speak about your theory where you say geography tells the story of a place, then you must layer the history and the politics over that to really see where somewhere might be headed. Will you just explain that to our listeners a little bit more?
Sure. Any country's story starts with its location, which sounds like it's obvious, but I don't think we think of things like in that manner. So in which direction do your rivers flow? Who's your neighbour? Are they bigger than you or smaller than you? Where do your borders stop? And does that mountain protect you or does it cut you off from trade? All these things are how our stories begin. And of course, it's not entirely deterministic because we then layer on, you know, all the events that happen and we try to change things and then the great ideas come from the people, etc. But unless you've got that geographic grounding, I think you're missing a huge element. I mean, on a sort of trite and large example, one of the things I think that has kept India and China from having a proper full-out war is that there's a massive wall between them called the Himalayas. Now, eventually, technology may overcome it, but we're a long way off that.
And one of your 10 chapters, you consider Britain, the place you're from. And to what extent do you believe geography explains Britain's rise as a world power?
Oh, hugely. I mean, you cannot underestimate it. Firstly, it's an island, and consequently, it's a group of islands, and has been protected from some of the excesses of politics on the continent, some of the extremes. But more than that, look at its coastline, very jagged. That means you've probably got deep water ports. That means you can have big ships. Okay, but if you need big ships, you need wood. What did the UK have a lot of? Not just wood, but oak trees, a very strong wood. When sail gives way to fossil fuels, what has the UK got masses of? Coal. And that allowed it to do what it did, and also its location right out there onto the sea lanes of the world with unencumbered. And so it all adds up. Oh, and I should add farmland capable of growing crops which can sustain a large population. Because you look at somewhere like Greece, it's a big country, there's only 10 million people there, and that's because most of it's mountains.
And you're very firmly of the view now that as Britain sets out on this new road post-Brexit, it has made its choice to align with the United States.
Yeah, without question. I mean, I don't know if you've covered it, because obviously it's UK, not Ireland, but the new British aircraft carrier sets off next month and with great fanfare. And where's it going? It's going to the South China Sea. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't think Beijing is quaking in its boots, and I don't think the Americans require a British aircraft carrier, even if it is shiny, because they've got 11 of their own. So why are we doing that? We're doing that because we've nailed our colours to the mast, and that mast is we're betting on the USA. We're not betting on China. We are prepared to anger them. We are prepared to anger them by getting rid of Huawei out of the phone company, out of the 5G system. Australia has made the same bet. And one of the themes of the book is that in this interim period of the multipolar world, where a lot of second-tier nations are jostling for position, they will use the time to get what they can. Some of them, and this has happened quicker than I thought it would, will make their choices. New Zealand is hedging its bets with China. Australia isn't. Australia's going with America. And all the nations that you see opposite China, like Japan, Taiwan, Philippines, they are also making their choices. And at the moment, everyone's going to stick with the Yanks.
I'm selfishly thinking of Ireland now and what choice we've made, because traditionally we have looked across the Atlantic, but we're also, of course, very much part of the EU. And that stance is seen even more clearly post-Brexit. We're in a very odd position, are we not?
You are, and you know, I don't want to get too much into the rights and wrongs of Brexit because it's such an emotional issue and it's a done deal anyway. But I don't think it's helped you. You now have to go round that large island in front of you for your market, your biggest market, you know, on the continent. And we are no longer part of it, so it's complicated it. But you will continue to look across the Atlantic. But this is not a boastful idea, but the UK is a leading second-tier nation. Ireland is a second-tier nation. You know, it's not one of the leading ones because it simply isn't big enough.
It doesn't have enough hunting
power. Yeah, you know, it's nothing to do with who's better or anything. But one of the luxuries of that is that you are able to play both sides. You are able to hedge your bets more because there's less pressure on you. I mean, the Americans would not breathe the sort of fire on you that they did with the Brits when the Brits looked like they were going to let Huawei into the 5G system, which is allegedly, well, it's a security issue. So I think Ireland can quite happily carry on trying to be friends with as many people as it has, which I would say you do a pretty good job of.
We'll take that as a win, Tim. Can we move on to the Middle East now? And you talk about oil, Saudi Arabia's primary resource, but you say that oil, although it made the country, of course, huge question marks over what happens next. You mentioned the great Saudi plan called Vision 2030. How might that country and region work if that plan is successfully implemented?
Well, yeah. And it has to work because, again, this is where the geography comes in. Because the modern way of looking at geography is not just soil samples, which is what made me not attend most of the lessons when my generation went to school. It was so boring. But it's actually much more interesting now because they put things like demographics in. So when they discovered oil, there was about 2 million of them. Well, it's 35 million people in Saudi Arabia now. So what on earth, how are you going to sustain 35 million people if the world has stopped buying the only real product you've got?
Yeah.
You have to diversify, and they've read the future, and that is this Vision 2030. So in that vision, they've diversified into tourism. They've diversified hugely into solar power because, of course, that's one of the things they've got a lot of. And they try to wean themselves, their economy, off having to sell because they know the rest of us are weaning ourselves off what they have to sell. But there's other things that flow from it. If America no longer really cares about Saudi Arabia, and it's already beginning to slowly withdraw from the region, then their security umbrella is no longer over Saudi. If, in that event, Iran remains deemed as a hostile nation, then it's no good the Saudi Arabians simply having all their shiny new weapons that they buy off the British and Americans. They have to be able to know how to use them because, with respect to them, they don't. And so they better get themselves a robust defense force or they better mend their fences with Iran. See, all these things flow originally from, well, the geography, but of course also the current affairs. You know, if we were happily going to carry on buying oil for the next 100 years, they would not be diversifying, but they've read the future.
Tim Marshall, former diplomatic editor at Sky News, talking about his new book, The Power of Geography, 10 Maps That Reveal the Future of Our World, on Today with Claire Byrne this morning. Well, that's it for this edition of Playback Daily. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio player. And there'll be another edition of Playback Daily tomorrow at the same time. But for me, Neil O'Sheridan, thank you for listening and good luck.